Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us again. Fooled me. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Stephen Long, author of the novel There's a Somebody, and I would love to hear from you at my website, stephenwlong.com, or the Facebook page, There's a Somebody. And, you know, I've been waiting quite some time to have this special interview with my friend and and author, Frank Lisciandro. So let me do two things. I want to talk about Frank a little bit and then about his new book. Frank is an award-winning filmmaker and a best-selling author. And Frank, correct me on any of this that is wrong, but I understand that you went to Michigan State University for photojournalism. Okay.
Yes.
And then studied cinematography at UCLA. What we want to talk about is your latest book titled Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together, and I'm going to have you elaborate on that. People, I think you'd have to live under a rock to not know Jim Morrison, but let me just say a couple of things about him. Rolling Stone readers picked Jim Morrison as fifth place in their magazine's Best Lead Singers of All Time, and Classic Rock magazine named him one of the 50 greatest singers in rock. So, and just a tidbit that I learned here this morning, there's actually a lizard named after Jim Morrison, Barbatorex morrisoni. And the fella said, this is a king lizard, and he was the lizard king. So that fits there. But I think probably a starting place would be to say, how did you and Jim Morrison meet?
Well, we met because we started at UCLA in the film department or the cinema department at the same time. And so we were thrown into classes together. And, just one of those coincidental things that, you know, you meet somebody because you're sitting next to them in class or because you're doing a class assignment with them or because you go out and have a coffee and there's the guy sitting in the cafeteria and talking to some friends of yours and you meet him. So, we had a lot of opportunities to meet each other during the days we were at UCLA. And that's when I first got to know him. And I got to know the keyboard player for the group, The Doors. They weren't The Doors at that time. I got to know him. Again, because he was a student at UCLA, a film student, and we lived in the same neighborhood, as students, and so we got to know each other. That was Ray Manzarek, and Ray and I became friends, and then eventually I got to hang out with the band and make photographs of the band, and so that's how that all started.
And so that people kind of get the connection of you and me. When we've talked before, you said that you were on stage for The Doors, but then when they left the stage, you'd stay on and photograph other bands. Who comes to mind there?
Well, I photographed some of the bands that appeared with The Doors, but, bands like the Chambers Brothers, usually opening acts. And Comfortable Chair, which was a band that was getting underway in the 60s. Of course, the Chambers Brothers, everybody knows them. Then I did other concerts, both in San Francisco. I photographed other concerts in San Francisco and Los Angeles area. Although I was not really a rock photographer. I mean, I didn't style myself or consider myself a rock photographer. I was a filmmaker during that time, and I was actually making films. That is, I was either working on a film crew or editing a film or making one of my own films. I was a photographer before I even arrived at UCLA because I had studied photojournalism at Michigan State. And even before I arrived at Michigan State, I was a photographer. So I always had that craft, that art form, that expressive art form to go back to, and I used it to photograph what I really love, which was the music of the 60s.
Mm-hmm. looking at some of the postings that you put on Facebook, which are just fascinating, and I think, you know, it's two-part. There's the photography, which is fascinating, and then the unedited interviews. And so many things come to my mind, but one is, what in the world was it like to be part of that scene and live in those times? Did you have a feeling of history, or was it just you get up in the morning and that's what you do, and that's what life was like?
There were moments, days, weeks, months even in the 60s, especially towards the latter part of the 60s, that I felt, sincerely felt, that I was living in a special time, in a special place. And my instinct at that point was to begin a project just by myself called either, I called it two different things. One was gathering evidence and the other was collecting evidence. And I was very much wanting to try to, I couldn't analyze what was going on around me. But I could, because I was a documentarian. I'd been taught to be a documentarian, a documentary still photographer. You know, photojournalist is essentially a documentarian, and I was taught to be a documentary filmmaker at UCLA. I was more interested in documentaries than I was in fiction films. So having that background of collecting evidence, gathering evidence, I simply started to make photographs or tape interviews with, or just tape, you know, put on audio tape whatever was going on around me, so that later on, in a quiet moment, I could analyze what was going on around me. So, yeah, I did really feel it was an important time. I thought we were striking a new renaissance in the arts and crafts, and I thought that our efforts against the war in Vietnam were historic, in that people were getting out on the street and shouting down the war. I thought we were all caught up in some sort of, I don't want to say magical time, but progressive time, a new renaissance.
Mm-hmm. You know, in preparing for this, I've thought about you during that time and the events that we hear about, and I thought about me at that time. And I was different, I think, in the sense that, you know, if somebody would portray me, it would be more the Ronnie Howard character in American Graffiti. I think I was observing all of this stuff, feeling that it was important, but less a part of it than I think you were. And it does seem like it was a special time. I suppose there have been revolutions, you know, throughout history, but this was ours. And this is what I think now has shaped us and shaped America. And I just admire you for being such a part of that. And I wanted to say also, you seem to have the presence of mind. You say you didn't always analyze where you were at the time. But I think the fact of capturing the evidence and knowing that now this is archived and we can go back at some point and, like you say, in a quiet time and analyze what in the heck was happening. And again, I admire your work for that. This iteration of your book is not the first. Some of this material was presented earlier, if I'm right. Tell us about
yes.
that.
Well, in 1990, there was a real effort to get a Doors movie made, a Hollywood movie about the Doors, or essentially about Jim Morrison, but they thought they'd call it The Doors, and that was the film eventually that Oliver Stone wrote and directed and was the one that's been released. But several years prior to that, 4 or 5 years prior to that, various companies, including, funny enough, you should mention Ron Howard, but Ron Howard's company, Imagine, were these companies, and I think finally Ron Howard's company, Imagine, got the contract or secured the contract. They were hiring screenwriters to try to put out a script about this character, Jim Morrison. You know, now we're talking at a time that Jim had been dead for at least 15 years when these scripts started to be written. And I started to get the notion, talking to some of these screenwriters, that they didn't have a single idea of who Jim Morrison was, or
right,
what the era was, or what it was all about. And I began to get a little bit worried about how my 60s was going to be represented in a movie, and how Jim was going to be represented, my friend Jim, and my other friends, and how my life was going to be represented, even if I was a peripheral character. So I began to think about trying to, again, gather evidence by doing interviews with all the people that I could think of that were both friends of mine and friends of Jim's, and having more conversations with them that I could put on tape, that I could edit later. But I wanted to go around and talk to them about Jim, and because I began to see in these screenplays that Jim was just being horribly misrepresented. And, of course, he's horribly misrepresented in the Stone movie. He doesn't seem like that guy. I mean, guy was a Hollywood fantasy of who Jim Morrison really was. I'm not saying the stage parts, because the stage performances by Val Kilmer were excellent. The dancing and the singing and the movements, and they got Val to look a little bit like Jim. But we have to remember that Jim on stage was an actor and was creating not only a role but actually a myth. And so to judge Jim Morrison by what he did on stage was to miss the point. Here was a guy that was trained in classical theater, was trained in film theater, he was trained in, you know, I mean, he knew all of that stuff. And mm-hmm. he knew that one of the roles of someone on stage was to not only entertain the audience, but to bring them to another place. So we've gone far afield from your question, Steve, but it's so complicated, this whole part of the story of Jim Morrison. What I tried to do was put on audio tape to preserve this sense of who he really was through the eyes of his eyes and stories of his friends. And I ended up, I think, interviewing about 15 people at that time. Long interviews, usually in more than an hour, some of them even multiple sessions, and until the person I was interviewing and myself, we were both usually worn out by the end of the interview, and we had said all we could say at that point. And then I got to transcribing those interviews, and Warner Books offered me a contract to do a book. They were more interested in a picture book than a book with any real information, because they thought, well, we could sell a picture book about Jim Morrison, and I had a lot of photographs that I had taken during the 60s. And I opened the book up to other photographers who also had taken pictures of the Doors, and since this book was not about me, it was about, in fact, I called it Jim Morrison Feast of Friends. There was all these friends that were telling me stories about Jim that I was going to put their stories together, and then I opened it up to other photographers who knew Jim or had photographed Jim, so there's not all my photographs in that book. And that book was eventually published in 1991, but I could only, again, by Warner Books, it's called Jim Morrison, Feast of Friends. It's out of print. In that book, I wanted to say, use more of these interviews, but I only had 176 pages, and over 100 of those pages were filled with photographs, so there was not a lot of opportunity for me to use large chunks of these interviews that I had done. So I wove them into a narrative, these interviews, and used bits and pieces of them. So that's how these interviews and or conversations, whatever you want to call them, came about.
But the original representation sounds so heavily edited. I feel, and I haven't even read it, so I suspect you must feel, that it's it misses the mark, or it's damned by faint praise, or it's just not a true representation of what took place.
Well, I tried to use bits and pieces of the interview because what I was doing was building a case for Jim Morrison. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough of a platform to build that case. 176-page book with 100 of the pages taken over by photographs is not 76 pages is not enough when you've got 15 people you've talked to. You don't have enough room to use big chunks of their interviews, meaningful chunks of their interviews. And so I could only use a bit. And the book was successful. Mm-hmm. Warner sold a bunch of them. People were interested in hearing about Jim Morrison. This was another slant on Jim. I thought at that time, well, it served its purpose. But then 3 years ago, I stumbled upon looking for something else, as we are often doing. I came upon this box and I opened it up, and there were these floppy disks and transcriptions and the original audio tapes that I saved together, and there were the interviews. And I started to read the transcriptions, and it occurred to me, because I wasn't in the heat of trying to gather evidence, I wasn't in the heat of trying to get a book done for Warner's and get it out at a certain time and collect all the photographs, I was just sitting there calmly reading through these transcripts, and it occurred to me that these transcripts were historical documents, that they needed to be published because they were talking about not only about Morrison and the Doors, but they were talking about the 60s, and they were talking about life on the Sunset Strip and what bands went through, and a whole variety of subjects that had to do with, by now, a fabled era in our history. And I thought, I've got to get these published somehow. Again, it was not about me. It was about the people who were sharing their stories and sharing their remembrances, generously sharing them. And I thought, these people have to be heard from. Many of them had never been interviewed before I interviewed them or had a conversation with them on tape. And some of them still hadn't been interviewed. So the genesis of the book that now is available on Amazon, is about putting these interviews, these conversations, out in the best form possible, as unedited as possible, so that people have the ability to read the whole interview and come to their own conclusion about who Jim Morrison was or what the 60s was about. And they don't have to rely on my opinion or some writer's opinion who had never met Jim, and but they can rely on the opinion of 13 people and myself who actually knew him in the flesh and did things with him and collaborated with him, and these people were a wide selection of the 60s occupations, although they were all, I should take back wide selection. They were a narrow selection of 60s occupations because most of them were involved in the music business in some way or form. Several of them weren't, but for the most part they were. And they tell us about Jim honestly, sincerely, truly, because they admired him. They didn't understand him perhaps at the time, but they admired him and they liked him, and they were they considered them friends of Jim's. Themselves friends of Jim's. So, we're up to the present with the book I have now.
Well, I have to tell you a couple of things. They were, that is, the Doors were meaningful to me. I remember getting their first album, and of course this was a 33 and a third LP, and wearing that sucker out, I'd come home from high school and play it and play it and play it. And I can't say I understood it, but I think sometimes poetry is like that, that it resonates, even though maybe the literal meaning is lost, and for me it was. That's one thing. The other thing that I'm so pleased about now is this, I think you did this with no agenda other than the truth. And to this point, the only thing that I knew about Jim Morrison was a quote I read from, again, probably somebody who didn't know him. And the quote was something like, Morrison is more interested in being a rock star than a musician. And so having read only that, that was my impression. I thought, oh, well, that's, that's disappointing, but that's the way it was. And now, because of your book coming out, I have done a little bit of research, and that was just false. That's just not the truth. And he sounds like such an interesting burn the candle at both ends kind of a person. And again, I'm not like that, and so it's interesting for me to read about somebody who is.
Well, he was definitely one who took things to extreme, although he really made a poor rock star, because he rejected early on the image of a rock star and, you know,
really?
Grew a beard and drank as much beer as he wanted, and you know, he didn't throw TVs out of hotel windows and do all those kinds of things. I mean, he was just a guy looking to try to figure out what the 60s were about, like all of us were, and he wanted to write poetry and write essays and have a platform to share them with other people. So he was just the opposite of what you would expect a rock star to be. Although at first I think he put on the guise, the sort of costume, and tried it out. Let's see what a rock star is going to be like. But within a year,
right.
a year and a half or two, he had rejected all of that and figured out that wasn't going to get him anywhere. And not only that, it was sort of a shallow role for him to play. He had more important fish to fry.
Mm-hmm. A couple things I want to ask you about. I'd never made this connection before, but Jim Morrison and Van Morrison, I guess that they did something together, a rendition of Gloria at, I think, the Whiskey a Go-Go. Do you know anything about that?
Well, when Van Morrison first came to the States, or we started to first hear his music, he was with a band called Them, T-H-E-M.
Right.
And it was the band that he brought to the Whiskey, and he had written Gloria. And it just so happened that when they were at the Whiskey, the Doors were also at the Whiskey. I think the Doors were the opening band for Them, because Them was coming over with a hit record. The Doors hadn't at that time had a hit record. And
right.
Someone out there probably knows a lot more about all the time sequencing of all of this than I do. I wasn't around. I didn't see them on stage together, but I understand that there were several times when they would sing together on stage, the two Morrisons. They were both kind of wild guys, young wild guys, both of them interested in writing songs, and both of them very interested in drinking.
That's what I understand. And, in fact, Jim gained some weight, didn't he?
Well, you know, there's a lot of photographs that show that he didn't really gain any weight, but occasionally he would have a beer belly, but that came and went. I have pictures of him as late as 1971, in fact, when he looked just about as slim as a person could look.
Okay.
He went in and out of this weight gain thing, this beer belly thing, from about the end of 68 all the way through the time he was in Paris in 71.
Sure.
But essentially, he was not a fat guy. His beard made him look heavier than, and beards do make men look heavier than he really was.
Which is why I'm clean shaven.
Yeah. Well, you're slim anyway.
We'll get into that later.
So,
no, but, yeah.
Bill Siddons, who was the manager at that time, said something very interesting in the interview. He said, I'm going to quote him because I've got it up here on my screen in front of me. He said, "Jim was totally not interested in the economic aspect of his career. I never met anybody like Jim. He was seemingly disconnected with the meaning of money. He truly had no interest in physical possessions." And I can confirm that observation by Bill. This was a person who was less interested in physical possessions and owning things in money than anybody I had met up to that point and anybody I've met since that point. I have not met the Dalai Lama, and I really haven't met too many spiritual people. And the only spiritual person that lived a life of no possessions that I've met in my life probably was equal to Jim in not owning anything. But he was this rock star who just didn't do the rock star kind of thing. In fact, at the end, he just said, well, okay, I've done that, been there, you know, and walked away from it. He walked away from a tour. He walked away from a newly produced album. He walked away from adulation and fame. And, he was walking into obscurity. I mean, that was his goal, to become as obscure as possible so he could have time to make films and write poetry and write essays and not be the center of attention and not have to carry the weight of a band and a record company and all these publicists and lawyers on his back anymore. He wanted free of all of that. And so very interesting guy in that he wasn't like anybody else. And I think he kind of set the tone for what the real purpose, the underlying purpose of some of the movements in the 60s were about. I mean, we were trying to get free of the economic vice grip that we had seen our parents in, and we were trying to be free up everything, free up rights for people to vote, stop wars. And I think Jim personified that. I mean, if he was going to live in the 60s during this particular era, he was going to, without telling us, without saying do this or do that, he was just going to actually do it. And that's what I think confused people. They just couldn't on this guy who was so liable to be everything their expectations did not expect. Mm.
Okay. And now, am I right? You guys made a movie together.
Well, we actually made two movies together.
Okay.
One is called An Hour. It's called one is called Highway, which mm-hmm. was a 35mm film that was that has never been released, and it's never been released because of who knows why. I don't even know why. There were four of us involved in the making of it. Jim considered us equals because we all played our own separate roles in the making of the film. It's a 50-minute experimental film. I guess that's the word that's most used. A bit surreal, but it's never been officially released.
Okay.
The other movie was called, interestingly enough, that was also called A Feast of Friends. And it was a documentary about the Doors that the Doors were making about themselves at that time. And I was the editor of that film. And Jim was sort of the overseer to make sure that the film got done. And got done in a way that was a little bit cutting edge for the time in documentary films.
Mm-hmm. So,
and that one has
that
not been... And that film has not... Excuse me, Steve. I just want to mention... And that film has not been officially released either.
Okay, but wasn't there some footage, at least, that you guys did that was used in the PBS special?
Yes, well...
American
yes,
Masters?
And,
yeah.
Yeah, that show, that documentary, so-called documentary, there was some footage of Highway used in that. They claim, the producers claim that footage was outtakes from Highway, but I question... that it was outtakes. I was the editor of Highway. I should know what outtakes are and
sure.
You know, what outtakes there were. They unfortunately just didn't have a theme for their documentary, it seems to me. They didn't have a reoccurring sort of image, and they used footage from Highway to give organization and structure to their documentary. I mean, it's not a bad documentary. It's about as shallow as a very thin piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. You know, something else I want to ask you about, and this actually, if I had solicited questions from people on my Facebook page, because I knew, of course, we were going to do this interview, and I have to say that one of the respondents, Jessica Crawley, asked, Do you think that Jim would have come back to the U.S. for his sentencing if he hadn't have died in Paris? And what that I'd like you to answer that, but then I also am thinking, as I read this, his by today's standards, his offenses were so minor, if they were offenses at all, I can't imagine this happening today. But do you want to comment on that?
Well, you know, the Miami trial was an appeal, and when Jim left the country. And most likely, the appeal court would have found him, would have thrown out the whole trial. I was there in Miami for part of the trial. I mean, it was a sham, and it was just one of those absolutely terrible one-sided trials in which the defense was not able to make a point, and the judge eventually got convicted of corruption. So I believe that the appeals court would have thrown the conviction out, and I think Jim knew that and his lawyers knew that, and they were feeling okay about Jim's conviction during that trial. So I don't think he had that on his mind. I don't think he was worried about that. Whether or not he would have come back to the States and continued a career in music, I don't think so. I think he had made a decision to do something different, and he was a pretty decisive sort of person. He might have come back and been a solo artist, or he might have come back and been an actor in films or a director in films. Obviously, there's more opportunity for him to be a creative person, a creative artist in the United States, because of language and all those other things. So I think he would have come back and done something.
Okay, but not as a result of this, not the trial. In fact, if I read correctly, the fine was like $500, which even then had to be insignificant for him.
Yeah, of course, the fine was, but I think there was also a charge in which he was going to have to go to, depending on how the judge, did the penalty phase of the trial, that he was going to have to go to some terrible jail in Florida and spend 6 months or something like that. And, of course, no one wanted him to do that, and so there would have been an enormous effort not to have him serve that sentence. They never clearly indicated during the trial, they never showed any documentary evidence that he, in fact, exposed himself. And it was a witch hunt. That's the best I can make of it.
Yeah, well, it sure sounds like it. Frank, why don't you mention your website and Facebook page as well?
Well, the Facebook page is simply called Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together. I'm trying to post on it excerpts from the book and pictures from the book. If people want to see my photographs, my website is franklisiandro.com. And I haven't even got a mention of the book on my website yet, but they can go to franklisiandro.com and see an interview that I did some years ago about the 60s and about my life in the 60s and about Jim Morrison, and read that interview on my website. As I say, I'm trying to post on the Facebook page excerpts from the books and photographs and share them with people. Facebook page
is
up.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big book. I think it's 392 pages, and it's got plenty of room so that we could use the majority, if not the majority, then close to the majority of each interview. I don't want to say the interviews are totally unedited, because for purposes of reading, we took out a lot of the not a lot, but we took out redundancies. If people would repeat themselves, and it didn't add up to anything, then we take those redundancies out. But we were very, very careful about lifting anything. Again, I consider these interviews historical, and I didn't want to mess with history.
Great. Well, Frank, let me re-mention, speaking of redundancy, my website, stephenwlong.com, Facebook page, There's a Somebody, and I'm sure you would love to hear from people, as I would. And I've been looking forward to this interview for such a long time, and I'm glad we got it together. And let me also mention that you're a heck of a pickleball player, and maybe let me win. Let me win one time, and I'll see you
and
later.
And I'd like to say, I just like to say a word to everybody who might be listening now or later, that Steve's book, There's a Somebody, is a fabulous read, a very sensitive story, I think, and it's interesting that the book is not, I can't say it's a guy's book or a gal's book. I just find it a book that draws you in to the character, and then you go through the character's perils and turmoils and happiness with him, and Steve's done a wonderful job of connecting you to a narrative with a central character.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. Say hi to Judy.
Okay.
And I'll talk to
you again soon.
Right.
Maybe play some pickleball.
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks,
see you
Steve.
Later. Thank you,
bye.
Frank. Bye-bye.
Left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money. you would have done.